All right, we are looking at chapters 12 to 15 in our study tonight. And so we have a little bit of ground to cover, but I think we can do that. And if we speed up at all, I think it will be in the song of chapter 15, or songs of chapter 15. Those are not unimportant, but we can speed through that a little quicker. All right, let's see where we are and where we've been. This is our outline that we're following from Baxter. And we are in the Exodus section, and then we'll move to the law in chapter 19, and then the tabernacle at chapter 25. And so we are in this third section, that is the first major section, point C, that is the Exodus is affected by Jehovah. It was obstructed by Pharaoh, projected through Moses, and it is going to be made effective through Jehovah. We're going to see some major events tonight. Some historical events are going to be talked about time and time again through the Old Testament. And so we'll have the 10th plague, and we'll have the literal exodus. They're leaving, and they're crossing through the Red Sea. And so those are major, major events. All of that's happening in our study tonight. So let's review our chapters of where we've been. Chapter 1. The children of Israel are suffering in Egypt. Chapter 2, Moses' birth. Yes, in early life. Very good. Chapter 3, yeah, the call of Moses to deliver the people of God. Chapter 4, he made excuses. He's not cut out for the job. And he made his trip to Egypt. Chapter 5, yeah, he made his request to Pharaoh and things got worse. And then chapter 6, I guess we're going to go to it next, probably. Yeah, God gives assurance to Moses and to Israel that he's going to be with them and he will deliver them. Then starting in chapter 7, we have the starting of the plagues. So we have Aaron's rod and then we have the first plague. Chapter 8 was second, third, and fourth plague, and then chapter 9, 5, 6, and 7, and then chapter 10 is 8 and 9, and then chapter 11, you think, well, that's the 10th plague. Well, it had to do with the announcement concerning the 10th plague, and the 10th plague is not going to come to our study tonight, and we'll get to that here in chapter 12. All right, here are the 10 plagues. There's the water to blood, there's the frogs, there's the lice, the flies, the disease of the livestock, the boils, the hell and fire, the locusts, the darkness, and the last one is the death of the firstborn. And that's what we're going to get to, and that'll carry us through chapter 12. All right, now we'll come back to that concept. We may not see that slide again, but we'll come back to that concept. Question number one, part A, is chapter 12 is about what? Yeah, the Passover, the institution of the Passover, and then there is the 10th plague. All right, while we're looking at our questions, let's go to question two. Read chapter 12, 1 to 28 carefully and answer the following questions. When would the observance of the Passover start? All right, in the first month, on the 10th day of the first month, and then they would kill the animal on the 14th. How long did it last? Did the feast last? 7 days from the 14th to the 21st. Now we'll come back to all of that. And then let's go ahead and get question three. What was Pharaoh's reaction to the 10th plague? Yeah, it was an emergency call. Y'all get out of here and y'all leave. And we'll come back to that here in a second. All right. Here's what happens in chapter 12. We have the Passover instituted, verses 1 to 28. Then we have the 10th plague sent. And then we have Pharaoh sends the Israelites out. And then there's the regulations concerning the Passover. So let's subdivide that first section and work through that. This is the institution of the Passover. So I like flagging chapters in our mind, if not in the literal text itself somehow, in the margin of your text if you have trouble remembering. But we're going to see the Passover time and again. We're going to go through the Old Testament and we'll see the Passover mentioned. We'll see it mentioned in the New Testament. And each time as we get away from this, we may forget some of the details. Chapter 12 is where we're going to go back and get our information about the Passover. Make sense? So this is information you'll need for further and other studies. All right, let's start with verses 1 and 2. The first thing is a new calendar is created for the Israelites. So God said to them, "This month shall be the beginning of your months. It shall be the first month of the year for you." Well, he doesn't identify the month until we get over to chapter 13. So let's get ahead of ourselves if we want to do that and go to chapter 13 and in verse 4. And so lest this become confusing a little later, on this day is going of your going out in the month of Abib. You might make a marginal note that that term, Abib, is parallel with our April. We'll look at that on the calendar here in a second. But the name Abib suggests the idea of green ears or the idea of the month of the young ears of grain. So say Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown in pulpit. And so that's what it literally means. It's the year of the green ears or the young grain of corn. Or some form of grain, not just corn as we would think of it. But it's the young grain. Now, when you look at a Jewish calendar, you don't see a bib on that, but Nisan is the month that would correspond with that. So you've seen this Jewish calendar several times. To interpret this, the outer circle starts with January, February, March, April. Here we are in April, and the start of the sacred year for the Jews, this inner circle here, is the Jewish calendar corresponding with ours, and the months doesn't run exactly start of month to end of month kind of thing. But this is where their month would start, and that's what he's talking about. But this is the month that became known as Nisan. So you'll look at other Bible references, and you may look in a commentary, and it'll say this was the month of Nisan or whatever. Same month we're talking about. So we don't have a contradiction here. So it was in this month, on the 10th day of the month, that we would have the Passover right here and the Feast of followed immediately by the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Make sense? So that's where we are. This is something they're going to do from now on until Christ brings an end to the law of Moses. They're going to keep this on. Make sense? All right. That's what we're talking about. All right. Now let's continue on with that. The new calendar has been started and created. In other words, God didn't create everything new, but we're going to start the Jewish year now. That's what he's saying. All right. Now beginning at verse 3, we see the Passover lamb and the Passover meal. So when was the lamb to be selected? On the 10th day of the month, verse 3, one lamb should be chosen on the 10th day of the month. We see that in verses 3 to 5. And if the household is too small, what do they do? Yeah, you'd have a neighbor and you're going to share with the neighbor and the lamb will be offered. And you're going to choose a lamb. What was the qualities of the lamb? Verse 5. Without blemish, a male, yeah, of the first year. And you may take it from the sheep or from the goats. And so that's the sacrifice that you're going to offer. Now, beginning at verse 6, we're following our outline. The lamb would be killed. And so what are we doing in verses 6 to 14? Or 6 and 7, rather. You shall keep it, you choose it on the 10th of the month, and then you wait till the 14th of the month, and the whole assembly shall kill it at twilight, and you shall take some of the blood and put it on the doorpost and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. That is, on each doorpost, each side of the door, and at the top of the door. That's the lintel. And so you put it on in three spots on either side of the door and at the top of the door. And so the blood could be seen. Now, beginning at verse 8, what do we do with the flesh? Or what would they do with the flesh? All right. They're to eat it. And it is to be roasted with fire. It's not to be boiled, but roasted with fire. You're going to cut its head off, right? Yeah. You do it with its head and its legs and its entrails. You're going to roast the whole thing. And you're going to eat it with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. Well, seemingly the unleavened bread has to do with the separation, or it doesn't have the leavening influence, obviously. So the unleavened bread may suggest the idea of separation from sin. And in this case, they're observing God passing over and separating them from Egypt. The bitter herbs has been suggested that maybe that was in remembrance of the bitter afflictions they had suffered in Egypt. So the Passover, we're going to see this time and again tonight, that as they observe it, and when questions are asked in future generations, you're going to explain it to your children. This is what it was like being in Egypt, and the Passover was the deliverance from that. Make sense? And so why are we eating these bitter herbs? Well, things were quite bitter in Egypt. Why the unleavened bread? We are to be unleavened and separated, impure, etc. Make sense? All right. Now, beginning at that gets us through verse 10. Now, verse 11, what's the point of verse 11? As they observe this, so what he's doing is like Jesus did in the Lord's Supper. He's not just instituting what goes on right in this first event, but this is what's going to go on time and time and time again as they observe it for generations. What's verse 11 saying? Yeah, you're going to wear your with your belt on your waist and your sandals on your feet and your staff in your hand. In other words, your loins are girded. And in other words, you're ready to depart at any time. And so as they observe that's going to be a memorial a reminder that when we observe the Passover, that when we did this, we were ready when God calls and we're going to leave and leave the land. And so we were ready at any time. We're not going to take time to get ready because we are ready. Make sense? All right, that's the institution of this part of the institution. Now, he's not through explaining the meaning of that, but here's the Passover lamb and the Passover meal that's to be observed for 7 days. All right, we're not through with that. Now then, here's the meaning of the Passover, verses 12 to 14. What's God saying beginning at verse 12? Here's what I'm about to do. He's already announced this in chapter 11. Yeah, I'm going to strike the firstborn of Egypt. That's the 10th plague, both man and beast. And notice this is a plague not only against Egypt themselves, but against their gods. All the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. So verse 13, you might underline part of this. Now the blood shall be a sign for you in the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. Hence the Passover. Make sense? So this was an observance or a memorial to remember God passing over them. So what would happen if the Israelites didn't kill the lamb, or they killed the lamb, but they didn't put the blood on the doorpost, so that when the plague comes, what's going to happen to their firstborn? They're going to die. So God said, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. See any parallel? You think blood needs to be seen for God to pass over us? Jesus is our Passover lamb. We'll say more about that in a moment as time permits. All right. Now, so you shall keep this as a memorial and as a feast throughout the generations. Now, beginning at verse 15. Now, 15 through 20, there is not only this Passover that you observe, but then following that immediately is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Distinct, but at the same time, it is to follow. So on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, how long is it going to last? Verse 15, 7 days. Very good. And on the first day, what are they going to do? Remove all the leaven from the house and until the seventh day, and the person who fails to do that shall be cut off from Israel. So on the first day shall be a holy convocation. What's a convocation? We don't, it's an assembly. That's a term that simply means assembly. You probably haven't heard anybody mention that we're glad to have you here at our convocation today. It's an assembly. So they're going to have this holy assembly on the first day. And there shall be no manner of work to be done on those days. That is the first day and the last day. And you shall observe, and you might underline, the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. So when we come later in the Old Testament, even into the New Testament, and there's references back to the Feast of Unleavened Bread, where are we going to go to find information? Exodus 12 is our text, where we're going to go. All right. And that I'll bring you out, and you shall observe this. Now, notice at verse 18, more information. In the first month, that's that month of Abib, or Nisan, on the 14th day of the month, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month. So there's your 7 days. They're going to observe that. All right. Any other questions on the observance of that down through verse 20 before Moses delivers all this information? There'd be no leaven found in the houses at all. And again, this was so strict that God said, if the person, look at verse 19, what happens if a person is found with leaven in their house? Cut off from Israel. Pretty severe, isn't it? It's not like they get a slap on the wrist and don't do that next time. They're cut off from Israel. So God was pretty severe about that. Now, beginning at verse 21 through 28, now we're still not through with the chapter. That's just this section when we get through. What's Moses doing here? Yeah, he calls the elders of the people and said, pick out lambs. He goes through all what God has just told him. And you're going to take some hyssop. You're going to kill the lamb. Verse 22, you're going to take some hyssop and you're going to put it on the lintel and the two doorposts. So three spots on the door. We're going to sprinkle blood. And you shall observe it as an ordinance for your sons forever. So this is not a one-time thing. This is a memorial feast that's going to go on for generations. And I'm interested now as we get on down. It should be as Passover sacrifice, verse 27. And it's in remembrance of God striking the household of Egypt. But now notice at verse 28 to finish that section. Then the children of Israel went away and did so. Reminds me of Genesis 6:22. Just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. Same phrase we find in Genesis 6. God told them, here's what we're going to do. That's what they went and did. So the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread has been established. Questions or comments? Now, while we're talking about the Passover, I borrow this from Willis in his little work on Exodus. Christ is our Passover lamb. The parallels and at times distinctions. We have the Passover lamb on one side and Christ on the other. It was to be a first firstborn male. Jesus was the firstborn male without blemish. He was without blemish. Not a bone broken. We haven't seen that yet, but we'll see that before we're through. Not a bone broken with Jesus, John 19. He saves from physical death, they were saved from physical death, over here spiritual death. This was a vicarious sacrifice, that is, the sacrifice of the lamb on behalf of the people, so over here with Christ. The blood was to be appropriated, that is, you didn't just shed the blood, but it had to be applied to the door. Blood has to be applied for us to receive the benefit. The lamb was to be eaten, we eat of the body of Christ. This was a sacrifice yearly. He's sacrificed once for all time. So the last one is a contrast, but it's still a sacrifice. Make sense? So when we read of Jesus being the Lamb of God, there seems to be an allusion back to chapter 12 of Exodus. Does that make sense? He is our Passover Lamb, 1 Corinthians 5:7. All right, now we're ready for the 10th plague to be executed. So let's start at verse 29. And in two verses, basically, this is the announcement of the execution of the 10th plague. Let's see what happens. At midnight, the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on the throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, that is, in prison. All the firstborn of the livestock. Now, we'll come back to verse 30. Think of the magnitude of that for a moment. All the firstborn, not a lot of them, not most of them, but all of the firstborn children from Pharaoh, the top, down to those that were in the dungeon of the prisons. I mean, the lowest of the rung to the top of the rung, every one of their firstborn, of their animals and of their children, died. Now, verse 30, what happens now? Good point. Do you think that if that were to happen in Bedford County, just limited to Bedford County, that every household, notice at the end of verse 30, there was not a house where one was not dead. That if there was somebody that died in every house in Bedford County, do you think maybe people could hear the wailing in the next county? I bet you could. I bet you Rutherford County would report, we heard the wailing. Every house in the county. You think of the land of Egypt, all over Egypt, every house, there wasn't a single family that wasn't touched by the death. God had said it would happen. He promised it would happen. Pharaoh didn't give. It happened. All right. Now, Pharaoh reacts to that. Let's start at verse 31. He called Moses and Aaron by night. No wonder. And he said, rise and go from among us, you and your children, and go serve the Lord just as you said. You've been begging to go, 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 go. Just get out of here. But he adds something else. Verse 32. This is... What's that? Bless me also. You think he's a bit humbled? I think that he's a little humble. Is he still arrogant? Absolutely. Is his heart still hard? You bet. We're going to see more about that in chapter, 14? A couple of references. In fact, three references in 14 that his heart was hardened. But he seems at the moment to be a little bit humble, that he's crying for a little bit of mercy. Bless me also. His household was affected. Your God has done this to us. So get out of here. Go, go, go. And the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste. I'm at verse 33. For they said, we're all going to die. Man, they had some real concern. So the people took their dough and they took off. Didn't even take time to finish what they were making. And they take off and they did according to the word. Now, I want you to just drop down. We had a question on this. Question number, what it? I'm not seeing my number. How many people came out of the land of Egypt? Yeah, question number four. What was the number? All right, 600 men on foot. That's soldiers, fighting men. That's the number. So we often talk about how many went into Egypt, by the way? 70 went in. How long has it been? We haven't seen that number yet, but we will tonight. So if you've studied ahead, you know the number. They've been there for how long? 430 years. So they've had time to grow. They went from 70. This is not 600,000 total. This is 600,000 fighting men, right? So that doesn't count women, that doesn't count children, and that doesn't count non-fighting men. So how many were there? We don't know. Some estimates are anywhere from 1.2 million, which is kind of low, to 2 million, more like 2 million, many scholars think. And so I'm not going to argue whether it's 1.2 or whether it's 1.5, 1.8. I'm not sure how we're going to argue that. But let's go with a round number of 2 million. And if you say, I think it's a little less, okay, then go with that. If you think it's more, go with that. Let's go with 2 million just for a moment. That's a lot of people. It took a while for them to come out. I believe it was Fields in his work in the College Press series that said, crossing over the river later as we come to chapter 14, that as they cross over the Red Sea, that is not the river, but the Red Sea, that if you put them a mile wide, or 1,000 people wide, that they would be 2 miles long in order to get across. I mean, this is a throng of people, 2 million people, perhaps. Now, let's flag this at verse 38. There was a mixed multitude. A mixed multitude. That's non-Israelites. These are Gentiles. That's going to be a thorn in their side before they get through. And so as they're leaving, there's a mixed multitude. There's some non-Jews. There's some non-Israelites that are going to end up being a thorn. Keep your eye on that mixed multitude. I don't mean watch it tonight because you're not going to see much more about it tonight. But let's watch for that because that's going to be a thorn in their side. and they're going up with him. Watch for that mixed multitude in your own life. That could be a danger. All right, now let's go on to down through verse 42 here. As Pharaoh sends them out, another key point we want to pay attention to is at verse 40, that they had been there for, you might underline, so we flag this a little later when we need to. They were there for how long? 430 years. They lived at Egypt 430 years, and this came to an end. So their long-awaited deliverance is now underway. They're getting ready to leave. Now, they haven't crossed the Red Sea yet. We haven't got to that. Come to chapter 14. Now, let's go to the regulations of the Passover that had just been instituted. There are basically three regulations that are given here in this text. What are they? I'm talking about verses 43 through the end of the chapter. All right, let's stop there. No foreigner, no Gentile, in other words, no stranger. That's the idea. You're Jews, you're Israelites, no stranger, no Gentile. So when you sit down to eat the Passover, that mixed multitude, they're not eating that with you. Don't let them eat. They're not. That's not part of. That's not for them. That makes sense. Second regulation. Say what? All right. Yes. Now, if one was had become circumcised and become a proselyte, they could partake. So, who is to partake? The second one was. Look at verse 46. Must be eaten in the house, not to be taken out of the house. And what was the third one at the end of verse 46? Nor shall you break any of its bones. So there was no the breaking of the bones of the Passover lamb. We talked about that significance just a moment ago. All right, we're going to leave chapter 12 for the moment. Make sense? Passover is instituted. The 10th plague came, was executed. Pharaoh says, y'all get out of here. We can't take this. I need mercy. Y'all go. And the people went and they left. And then here's the regulations concerning the Passover. All right, let's go to chapter 13 now. What's chapter 13 about? Question number one, B. All right, yeah, the firstborn is sanctified. And here's more about the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. And then there's the Exodus by way of the wilderness. And we'll see if we can pick the pace up a little bit because I want to get to 14 and hit at 15 just a little bit if we can. So in verse 1 and 2, and then this picks up again in 11 to 16. We'll split that here in just a second. But sanctify me to the firstborn that opens the womb. The details are given in 11 to 16. So we'll come back to that. Let's go ahead and go in the order in which the verses appear. So both man and animal, they belong to me. The firstborn belongs to me. All right. Now then, let's talk about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. This is to take place. Said Moses said to the people, remember the day that we went out of Egypt in the house of bondage by the strength of the hand of the Lord, etc. And no leavened bread shall be eaten. Now here again, verse 4, we flag the month Abib. If you didn't make a note then, might make a margin note. That's the same as Nisan, N-I-S-A-N. On our chart, our map, our graph, I guess is what I'm trying to say, that we had a moment ago. And it simply means the month of the green plants or the green corn. Now, what else do we see down through verse 10? Every year it's to be observed. And it tells again the details of the 7 days you shall eat the unleavened bread. But I want to pay attention to verse 8 now. And you might make a marginal note. This is a teachable occasion. We have teachable occasions in our lives. And what we mean by that, there are occasions when we're doing something, whether it's in our homes or in service or wherever, and our children or somebody else ask, what's that all about? It's a teachable occasion. So when your son asks, what is all this? So your child gets big enough and they, what's this thing about killing the Passover and the blood and what's this Feast of Unleavened Bread? This is an occasion for you to say, here's what that means. And it's a teachable occasion. We have teachable occasions. When the Lord's Supper is observed, when someone is baptized, etc. Now notice verse 9. This shall be a sign to your hand and a memorial between your eyes. I think his point, I don't have time to look up. If somebody wants to look up, I believe it's the New Century version, and read that for me, you can. At verse 9. But what it basically is saying here is this memorial is like having it, let me find my wording here, as if you had a sign written on your hand. It's a reminder. And as if you had some sign between your eyes, it's going to serve as a reminder and a memorial that, here's the goal you might underline, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. Now, what does that mean? Well, I take it to mean that you're going to be telling and speaking of this being a matter of law. God told us to do this. And so every time we observe this, there's going to be questions asked. And when questions are asked, you get to tell people we do this because this is a memorial and this is God's law. Does that make sense? So when somebody says, why are you observing the Lord's Supper? Well, it gives you an occasion for the law not to depart out of your mouth. Make sense? Why are people being baptized? Because this is what God commanded. Did anybody find the New Century on that? Verse 9, yes. Yeah, that captures the thought, I thought, when I saw that earlier. All right. Now, the law of the firstborn here, but let's go back to 11 to 16, that the firstborn is, if it is an unclean animal, you can redeem it, like verse 13, such as a donkey could be redeemed. And if it's not going to be redeemed, you kill it, you break its neck. Look at verse 13, you might make a marginal note to about Numbers. You may already have this in your marginal notes, but if not, Numbers 3, 46 and 47, 5 shekels could be paid. Now you say, I don't see 5 shekels in that. You'll find it over Numbers. That's why we're flagging that. For the firstborn man to be redeemed. Verse 14, flag again, this is a teachable occasion. So that when the questions come up, you get to teach and tell your children, this is what happened, and by the strength of the hand of the Lord, we're brought out of the house of bondage. And again, it comes as a sign, reminder, of like something on your hand or between your eyes. All right, now let's go to 17 to 27. We've got to flag some information here that's quite interesting. God's not going to send them the direct route. They're going to go by way of the wilderness. Now, if you've looked at about 10 commentaries and 10 different scholars on the Exodus route, you may have got 5 or 6 different concepts. There's different views on that, and we'll flag some of those for you. But this is traditional what they did. They came out in this red line. I think that's red, isn't it? Anyway, coming down through here and making their way up into the land of Canaan. But we're interested in going to Sinai right now. That's the traditional route. I'll come to the other routes in a moment. But rather than for them to take off in this direction from here's where they are, to make their way across the wilderness and up to the land of Jordan, God's going to send them through the wilderness. He's going to send them a different route. Now, why is that? Well, look at verse 17. Lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. Now, you might flag to the margin to see chapter 14 and verse 11. We'll comment on it in a moment. But I take it that what God is saying, I'm not going to let them go because they'll have to battle and fight the Philistines. And I'm paraphrasing what I think this verse is saying. You don't have the faith and the strength to fight and have war just yet. Evidence of that will be in chapter 14 here in a moment. And that's going to be in spite of seeing the seed part and the plagues they just saw. They still don't have enough faith and strength to fight the Philistines. So I'm not going to let you go there. I'm going to send you another route. Make sense? So one more thing we want to mention. They're going to encamp at Etham. Etham is here, is where most think it is. Others think that Etham is way on down here. Hence some variation in the route. We'll get to that in a moment. We'll flag one more thing before we go to 14. What happens in 21? This is something we will see time and again through the Old Testament. When God gets ready to move and guide them, how is he guiding them? pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Flag that, underline that. And when we come across that, then you go back to chapter 13. All right. Now, I do want to mention this before we get to 14. Generally, this is the traditional route of coming out, making their way to Etham, and then crossing the Red Sea at the northern point of this gulf of Suez. That's the traditional. If any of you are familiar with, give me a second, Stephen Rudd's material, he's a member of the church. You hear me recommend Bible.ca, that's him. He has done tremendous amount of work. He thinks, though I'm not convinced, that this route, that they don't cross the Red Sea to right here about where it says the Gulf, and that Mount Sinai is about where the middle of my circle is. And he's convinced of that. And I'll let you read his 200-400 page work on that if you want to go through that. I'm not going to wade through that for you. I haven't read all of that, but that's just his general idea. This map was put together by some of our own brethren and who am I trying to think of? What's Leon's idol that he quotes all the time? No, not Farrell. Well, Farrell, I think, would agree with that. Wrote the Bible history and geography. Bob Waldron. Bob and Sandra thinks this route here is, and they were quite scholars on the geography. They think this is correct. But anyway, let's go to chapter 14 now. So let's cross the Red Sea here. What happens in chapter 14? You might flag and underline it, verse 4, verse 8. And if I can get my pages separated once more, at verse 17, the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. We've talked about that already, and we flagged those verses a little bit earlier. So there's some places that are mentioned at verse 14. What happens is that Pharaoh and the Egyptians pursue the people of God. Now, where are those cities that are mentioned at verse 2? Well, what happens in verses 1 and 2, the children of Israel are told to turn. And those are let me go right here, thought to be east of Ramses. Now notice you'll see three locations for one of the cities here. So which is it? We don't know. That's why it's a little hard to pinpoint. We don't know the exact location of those cities, but they're thought to be east of Ramses. So what am I learning from verses 1 and 2? Is that they're taking off and God has them to turn. Some think they had them to turn northern from where they were headed. Others think they were turning south from where they were headed. Let me go back to this map. I take it that they were turning south. In other words, God wants them, apparently, to, if you can follow the little arrow in my circle, to come down here and make it appear that they're trapped as they cross into getting ready to cross the sea. So that Pharaoh will think, I've got him trapped against the sea, and I will harden his heart. So what God's going to do is, I will gain honor, verse 4, and I will harden his heart. Now flag verse 8, when they get ready to do that, he comes after them with 600 chariots, and he pursues them. The children of Israel went out with boldness. They're quite bold. Now that's going to change. Now when they finally get there and get up against the sea, what happens? They say they are, verse 10, very afraid. And they say, we'd be better to have been back in Egypt. There's no graves in Egypt. Did you bring us out here? Now, verse 11 is proof that what God had said back in chapter 13 was correct. You're not ready to go fight a war. That's why I flagged 14 and 11. There's your proof that 13 and 17 was correct. Does that make sense? You can't do this. You can't fight. You're not strong enough yet. And so what Moses said to them when they start complaining, what does he say? He says basically two things. Yes. Don't be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. The Lord will fight for you. He said, and then he said, and you shall hold your peace. In other words, that's, you need to hush up. That's what he's telling them. You just need to hush up about this complaining. You're about to see some amazing things take place, and you're going to see a cross over the Red Sea. All right. So now verses 15 to 25, they passed over. He told him to lift your rod and the sea and divide it. And notice now down at verse 21, when he stretched out his hand, what happened to the sea? So that there's a wall on either side of them. And what about the land they cross over on? An east wind came and dries the sea. Now you think about it, how long it would take to dry that much land out naturally, yet God dries it out where they could cross over that day. And they cross over on dry land and the waters were divided. Now with the cloud above them, no wonder 1 Corinthians 10 talks about they were baptized in the cloud and in the sea. They're completely covered by the sea on either side and the cloud above them. Called a baptism in 1 Corinthians 10. So the Egyptians pursued them. And notice now at verse 25, God troubled the Egyptians. 24, he troubled the Egyptians. And he caused the Egyptian, the wheels of their chariots, he took off the wheels of their chariots. Well, the Septuagint says he clogged their axles. Psalm 77, verses 16 to 20 said God caused it to rain upon them. They're going across on dry land, but as they come in on the dry land thinking they're going to pass, God causes it to rain and he clogs their wheels, clogs their axles, so that they get mired down or prevents their chariots from rolling. And that way God protects them. Interesting thing God did, and I don't know of another occasion where God did this, he took the cloud that was always before them. Now what's he do with it? Verse 19. He puts it behind them to put protection between them and the Egyptians. And then when the Egyptians come in, then the Egyptians are drowned. Now notice at verse 25, the Egyptians wanted to flee once they see what's going on because they said, Lord fights for them and against us. I made a marginal note, a little late thinking of that. A little late thinking on that. They should have thought of that a little earlier. But just a little bit too late. Now let's flag some things here about a change in attitude. Verse 4 or verse 8, they were bold when they took off. Then they became afraid when the Egyptians crowd them in. But when they saw, verse 30 and 31, that the Lord saved Israel that day, then the people did what? Feared God. Boldness turned to being afraid, which turned to back to fear of God. Make sense? Now our time is gone. We may touch on this next time. I'll try to do this next time. Come back and start at chapter 15. But this is the song of deliverance once they came out. But we've covered the bulk of what went on. We'll try to pick up at chapter 15. Rather than do a hurried look, we'll talk about some things in chapter 15 next time. We better stop right there.